Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast that has dedicated itself to the discussion and review of public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and with me, as always, is the best podcasting partner I could ever hope for, and I'm not lying, it's Lydia.
I desperately want you to just edit in the Tarzan call right there. That would be me. Hi.
Hi. Awesome to talk with you again.
Same for me, as always.
Before we go any further, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphan Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcasts and wherever you choose to listen. If you have the option to do so, please rate and review the show. It really does help get the show out to more people. Another great way to help is just by sharing the episode you're listening to on whatever social media platform you use. You can follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel, which is just shy of 6,000 subscribers now.
Woohoo!
Pretty amazing.
It is.
Kept Husbands is actually doing really well as a video, as a, one of the movies on there.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
There are a lot of people that are fans of that film, big fans of Joe McCrea, and even some fans of Ned Sparks. So, to each their own.
Well, we love Joel McCrea, just not that particular movie.
Yes. If you would like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanentertainment@gmail.com. Let's go ahead and listen to an Ellery Queen one-minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, Africa Screams!
Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the canned music. Sometimes the merest slip, the slightest word or two, can trip up a suspect, particularly when it's a serious charge. In this case, the charge was murder, and police were holding a youthful suspect. He claimed he was skating with a friend at the time of the murder in a beautiful new rink with stereo, indirect lighting, the works. Skating to the skater's waltz, he said, was great fun. I believe you're lying, I said. And in a moment, I'll explain.
Greetings! Welcome to Film Gazers, a podcast focusing on the science fiction, horror, fantasy, trinity, and 20th century entertainment. I'm Steph.
I'm Jess. We're cousins slash besties. Join us as we reminisce, discuss, and review films from our childhood.
Follow on Instagram @FilmGazers and listen to the show wherever you like to get your podcasts.
Later, taters!
In the case of the canned music, a new modern skating rink would probably play modern music, not the skater's waltz. I checked the rink, and the manager proved I was correct. He hadn't even heard of the skater's waltz. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Africa Screams is a 1949 film starring the comedy duo Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. The two were under contract with Universal Pictures, but they were allowed to make one independent film a year. This one was produced by Edward Nasser and Huntington Hartford and filmed at Nasser Studios. The film stars the aforementioned Abbott and Costello and has appearances from famed hunter and animal trainers Clyde Beatty, who provided his own animals for the shoot, and Frank Buck. Former professional boxers Max and Buddy Bear, and two actors that each had a turn as one of the Three Stooges, Champ Howard and Joe Besser. In the film, a woman, Diana Emerson, played by Hilary Brook, is seeking an old book, Dark Safari. She wants the map that was in the book. Two department store book counter workers, Stanley and Buzz, know of the book. Stanley recently read it before they sold their last copy. He claims to remember everything in it. So Diana is willing to pay him $2,500 to come to her house and draw the map. Once at the house, Buzz overhears her talking with Clyde Beatty and that she is willing to pay him $20,000 to lead an expedition to Africa. Hatching a plan to get even more money out of her, the two pose as knowledgeable big game hunters and insist on traveling to Africa. Once there, the danger and the hilarity ramp up as the group collects big game and Diana searches for bigger riches. Abbott and Costello filled the film and production with family and friends, and the film ran way over budget, much to the consternation of Nasser. Ed Nasser was so stressed at the overruns that a joke on the set was that it should be retitled Nasser Screams. This would be the first time that Abbott and Costello would work with Hilary Brooke and Joe Besser, but the two would become regulars on the Abbott and Costello television show. In 1953, the film was purchased by distributor Robert Haglag when the duo was forced to sell off the rights to many of their films because of strife with the Internal Revenue Service over owed back taxes. Haglag failed to renew the copyright in 1977, causing the movie to fall into the public domain under the then copyright laws. Abbott and Costello first worked together in 1935 in New York City. Costello's regular partner fell ill and Abbott took his place for a show. The two had great chemistry and soon the two began touring together. They first appeared on radio in 1938 on the Kate Smith Radio Hour, and it was on this show that they first performed their famous Who's on First routine. This routine was a huge hit, and they performed it numerous times throughout their career. They began their own radio show in 1940, about the same time as they made their feature film debut in the film One Night in the Tropics. Cast in just supporting roles, they stole the film with their Who's on First. The film was a huge success and made Abbott and Costello movie stars. They signed a two-picture deal with Universal, which resulted in their first starring feature Buck Privates in 41, followed by Hold That Ghost, In the Navy, and Ride 'Em Cowboy all in that same year. In 1943, Costello caught rheumatic fever after returning from touring army bases. He was bedridden for nearly 6 months and he didn't return to radio for nearly a year. On November 4th of 1943, he returned to perform on the radio with Abbott. Right before they were to go on to a live broadcast, Costello learned of the accidental drowning of his infant son, Lou Jr.,
in the
family swimming pool. He went on the air and managed to make it through the performance before breaking down and leaving the studio. In 1944, he and Abbott went to MGM on loan from Universal and filmed Lost in Harem, then did In Society, and Here Come the Coeds in 1945 for Universal. Also in 1945, the film The Naughty 90s was released, in which they again performed their Who's on First routine. And this version of the act is widely considered the best performance of the routine. They continued to work together and make several more pictures throughout the 40s. At one point, there was a disagreement between the two that left Costello refusing to speak to Abbott unless they were performing. Apparently, Abbott hired a servant that Costello had fired. Two films made in 1946, they starred as separate characters and not as a duo. None of these films did particularly well at the box office. Abbott managed to mend the rift between them when he suggested naming a pet charity of Costello's, which was a foundation to help underprivileged children, the Lou Costello Jr. Youth Foundation. This organization opened its doors in 1947 and it is still in operation today. The duo worked together on film and television and radio until 1957. And there is so much more to these two that I can't possibly cover it all here. I highly recommend the book Abbott and Costello in Hollywood by Bob Firmenich and Ron Palumbo. If you want a really great deep dive into their lives and careers throughout the 40s, I read that a couple years ago and it was really interesting. It was a great book. Just real quick, I want to mention Shemp Howard and Joe Besser. Howard was one of the original Three Stooges, appearing with the trio from 1923 to 1932, before leaving for a successful career as a film comedian. He reunited with his brother Mo and friend Larry in 1946 after Howard's replacement, Curly, became too ill to perform. He stayed with the team until his death in 1955. At that time, comedian Joe Besser took over. He was already a successful comic actor, even stepping in for Lou Costello occasionally on their radio program and appearing on their television show as a semi-regular character. His type of humor and character, that of the kind of a whiny, loudmouth man-child, didn't really fit in the Stooges' act, and after a brief 2 years, he left the team. He worked in film, radio, and television, including doing voice work for several animated characters for Hanna-Barbera, well into the early 80s. And despite their connections to the Three Stooges, Africa Screams is the only time that Shemp Howard and Joe Besser appear, albeit briefly, together on screen. Now, Lydia, I was curious for you. I know, you know, you've watched probably a lot more films from this era until we started doing this podcast anyway than I have. You grew up watching older films and everything, but I am curious what your history and thought on Abbott and Costello is.
That's a really interesting question. The very, very brief answer is almost nothing.
Oh, okay.
Same with the Three Stooges. Somehow the slapstick comedy gene missed me. And I don't think this is news. I think anybody that's listened to us for a little while is kind of aware of this. So yeah, so not a whole lot, actually. What's really funny is I was just looking through Joe Besser a little bit and some other, you know, it just, the things that I connect with are not the things I think a lot of people would connect with. He was in The Desert Hawk, which is one of my favorite movies that is virtually lost. I can't find a version of it. Every once in a while, I think I mention it and say, hey, if you know where I can get a copy of The Desert Hawk, please let me know. It's Richard Green and Von DiCarlo and him, too. And also, I say a very young Rock Hudson. It was almost his first screen appearance. So it's just, the slapstick comedy gene kind of missed me. And I think I need to say there are a couple of different versions of this movie. One of them is a color version that seems to be about a half hour longer than the version that's on the Orphaned Entertainment Channel. Kind of weird, right? Yeah. And I'm not sure what the disconnect is there. It is definitely the same movie, but it's posted on YouTube. You can find it very easily if you search for this movie. It's one of the first ones that comes up. And it's the one I watched first. The sound quality didn't seem to be very good on it. Maybe it was the device I was watching it on, but I don't think I laughed at all watching this movie the first time. And there were a number of times I was really excited at the idea of just fast forwarding. And so when I went back and rewatched it, I thought, you know, I'll watch the Orphaned Entertainment version of it. And I'm not, I have no idea why they're so different, but I saw that it was much shorter and immediately thought, oh, thank God. It also, the sound quality seemed a lot better for me, maybe because I was watching with headphones, and I actually started laughing at some of the stuff. There's a lot of kind of, I would describe what Costello does as being a bit like Bob Hope. So they really actually strongly reminded me of Bing Crosby and Bob Hope in the Road movies. And I don't know why Bob Hope would be funnier to me than Costello would. I don't know what it is. There were definitely parts in it. Like there's a scene pretty early on, a gag with a spigot where, you know, there's a bit where they get, you know, the spigot caught on their fingers and there's that classic gag where somebody gets sprayed in the face. And I was first of all really impressed with the gag in the way that they filmed it. I thought was flawless, was just seamless. But also just very, very unexpected. It definitely made me chuckle. But I think my experience with this was, it was interesting because I felt a lot like Bing Crosby and Bob Hope, with the exception that there's always a femme fatale or, you know, a lady interest in the Bing Crosby and Bob Hope ones. And there's not one in this, which I found really interesting. There is a beautiful lady, of course. We didn't talk about Hilary Brook, and I frankly don't know if we've come across her in the past. She's kind of your classic. I would say she's like a classic Goldwyn girl almost. She's like a Virginia Mayo. I think, you know, she's very pretty, but she seems to have been cast in kind of more of a femme fatale kind of bad girl role. She's definitely been in some other things. She was in with Doris Day and Jimmy Stewart, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and of course a bunch of other things as well. But it's interesting that there's just no female interest in this, no female love interest, I should say, in this movie, even though there's what we would today call a strong female character. So I found that fascinating. And I think she can't pass the Bechdel test because there's really only one female in this entire movie, which is unfortunate because in every other way she passes. She, at no point, I think, is she talking about, you know, men or interest in men or anything like that. She's really a strong, cool character, but definitely not the type that you typically see in, I think, a lot of other comedies during this time.
No, absolutely. And there's a lot of Abbott and Costello time or Abbott and Costello films where there is a girl that usually is sweet on Costello, but Abbott's constantly trying to, you know, woo her away.
Yeah. And there's a different character. I don't want to give anything away, but I think there's a character that takes the place of that. You're giving me a little kind of surprised look. It's
Are you talking about the gorilla?
I was talking about the gorilla. I didn't know if I should pull that out or not. But it is kind of funny. And it made me again think of Crosby and Hope, that there's a scene, I think, in The Road to Bali where Bob Hope ends up actually getting picked up by a female gorilla and carried off into the jungle by her. And this made me kind of think along those lines. Now I'm really curious. I feel like I need to go and check and see if The Road to Bali is later. I bet it is, because it feels like they just took what was in this movie and kind of stretched it a little bit further. So, yeah, definitely some familiar themes going on here.
Yeah, Road to Bali was 52, so it was a few years after this.
Just a couple of years, yeah. So And they've got the same monkeys. At one point, there's some little monkeys up a tree, and I said, hey, I've seen that monkey before. He's in The Road to Bali. And then, of course, later there's the gorilla, and I thought, well, it's a very different storyline, which I appreciate. It doesn't feel like they've just recycled the storyline, but it is funny. There are just some familiar themes in there.
Yeah. There was a little bit of trivia I read somewhere, and take it as with a grain of salt since it's online, but supposedly there was originally the gorilla was going to be a female gorilla, but the censors kind of put the kibosh on that because they were afraid someone might think of bestiality.
Well, that didn't bother them in the remake of Planet of the Apes, so I guess we're past that, aren't we? Interesting that it didn't make it then, but it did make it 2 or 3 years later.
Yeah, no, that is odd.
Mm-hmm.
I'm familiar with Abbott and Costello. I really enjoy Abbott and Costello, but amazingly, there's a lot of movies that I've not seen, but I've seen some of their television show. I've listened to a lot of their radio program.
Mm-hmm.
This film is actually probably one of the lesser films of Abbott and Costello. This film, and that's why I was asking how familiar we're with the duo. The thing that I kind of find missing most in this film is their routines.
Yes, I 100% agree, even not knowing very much about them.
Yeah, most of their films, they work in one or two of their kind of classic, whether it's Who's On First or Abbott and Costello trying to make, nine times seven equals 49 or something like that. I forget, mm-hmm. He does this math thing, and it's so much fun. Trying to describe the routines is not a good idea, so I'm going to stop there. But this film really doesn't have that, and it does rely a little bit more on the slapstick. And I'm kind of the same with you. I mean, a little slapstick it's all right, mm-hmm. but yeah, that's not the thing that's going to make... I'm not going to laugh at someone falling over tripping over their feet or falling over their shelf, the bookshelf or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were parts in it where it felt like Costello was like holding up one end of a routine, like when he's talking to Beatty, which I definitely want to talk about him a little bit because I think that I didn't know who he was before this movie, Clyde Beatty. For anybody that doesn't know, he was the most famous lion tamer of all time in the United States, and wrote a number of books. I did pick up his book, The Big Cage, and began reading it. Let's just say PETA would not be happy.
Oh, no.
There's so much in this movie that I looked over at my husband at one point and said, oh, PETA would not be happy. And he's like, no. And it, the good news is there's no like blatant animal abuse, but there also is definitely blatant not used anymore training practices.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's there. You know, there were no clickers back then, and it is interesting. He's in the cage with some lions at one point, and I guarantee you the gun he's got in his holster is a real gun because that was how he trained them. He, you know, used literally a whip, a real whip, and literally a chair, a real chair. For those of you guys wondering if that chair was CG, it's not. It's, and then, you know, and he had a gun, and that was for self-protection. So I think, actually, if you're interested in reading a historical book by a lion tamer from the 1930s forward, it's fascinating. He's got just a slew of really, really interesting stories in it. He didn't only tame lions. He did tigers, bears. He did a lion and pony act where the lion would jump up on the horse's back on a platform on the horse and, you know, ride around. He basically was the foremost trainer of big cats for circuses. It's really fascinating. And I found it really interesting that, you know, going into this movie, not knowing who he was, seeing this guy, you really very quickly pick up once he's in with these lions there. He's really in with the lions.
Yeah.
There are a couple of scenes where Abbott or Costello is on screen with a lion, but you can figure out that it's done as a split screen. You can tell, like, mm-hmm. If you think about it hard at all, you're like, oh, yeah, they probably did it this way. Yeah. He's not on a split screen. He's in there with the lions.
Yep, absolutely. They did a little bit of split screen and then rear projection, I think, mm-hmm. The scene with Costello in the cage with the lion behind him.
Yes.
But, you know, actually, for 1949, it's a pretty good rear projection.
It is.
I mean, it's just off enough that you can tell that Costello is against the wall.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, and I think he's not reacting quite at the right times.
Mm-hmm.
But the split screen, I honestly, without thinking about it, I wouldn't have even thought about it being a split screen. Like, if I weren't thinking about how did they make this movie, I wouldn't have questioned it.
I was kind of surprised that Abbott actually picks up a cub, a lion cub at one point, and holds it. I'm like, oh, wow.
I'm pretty sure I was saying, oh, cute.
Oh, it is adorable. I'm like, how cool is that? He gets to hold a lion cub.
Yes.
But yeah, it was surprising that you have your star with an actual wild animal cub mm-hmm. in his arms.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you listen to Clyde Beatty, that is like the tamest animal that you'll ever see is a cub raised in captivity. Mm. So it's interesting. Some really interesting attitudes in that book. But yeah, I think that there's a lot. Talking about the lion cub, there are things that happen. It's pretty predictable. Everything that happens, they set up the joke way ahead of time. And then the execution is all reliant on Costello's facial and verbal reactions. And so...
And honestly, that's kind of one of the things I really love. Mm-hmm. I love the way... I love him as a reaction comic.
Well, I think to me, and this is going to tell you guys so much about it, the funniest part to me is after that moment that I mentioned with the face spray, he turns and he looks straight down the barrel of the camera and he goes, think about it. Think about what just happened. Like, yeah. He's like, the water came out. Yeah, how did that happen? Like, he's
yes.
literally looking at you saying, hey, stop and think just a second about what we just did. That was pretty crazy.
I turned it, the water came out, but... I love it. That little routine with the water spigot, mm-hmm. you know, it stuck on his finger. He passes his hat to Joe Besser, and then suddenly the spigot's on Joe Besser's finger. He can't get it off, and he's trying to get it up. That whole routine between the two of them, and that's actually probably maybe my favorite bit in this movie.
Oh, by far, I believe it is the funniest.
And then he turns the spigot, and the water sprays Joe Besser in the face. And then that Costello suddenly goes, how in the world, you know, he's questioning
yes.
the physics of what just, you know, transpired in this comedy film.
Yeah.
I think that's so, it's meta funny.
It is. That's exactly, it's that kind of next level. Oh, wait a minute. There's something a little bit more going on here. Somebody falling down, you know, everybody laughs when somebody slips on a banana peel, but that kind of more elevated intellectual humor sounded so pretentious when I said those words all in a row. But that is, I appreciate that. Usually you'll hear me say I prefer British humor. And, you know, it makes you think just a minute. And often it's something that's really unexpected. And I think that's my biggest complaint about Abbott and Costello is that it's almost never unexpected. It's almost always the things that you know are going to happen because they're setting the joke up way ahead of time.
Sure.
Which is fine. There's not that there's anything wrong with that. No, but it is it's a very specific type of comedy.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
I will say too, I find this funnier. This is to me is like a healthy balance between, let's say, the Three Stooges and something a little more. I'm going to use another big word, erudite.
No, I agree. Yeah, Three Stooges. When I was a little kid, I remember watching Three Stooges shorts and films and thinking they were pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
I can even look back on them now and think that wasn't funny. You know, that's they're being cruel. They're being mean. You know, it's disgusting. It's not funny to me anymore. That kind of humor. Yeah, this film is a nice in-between of where it's a little bit more intelligent, but it's got that sort of lowbrow stuff. And it occasionally mixes in stuff that's just so zany that it's just, you can't help but kind of chuckle at it. You get the thing with the spigot that's probably my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, they're in Africa, and Abbott and Costello are arguing in their tent. And the whole time they're arguing, Joe Besser keeps running back and forth, gets a cup of water, runs out.
Tiny
comes
cup.
Back, cup of water, runs out.
Where are you going with the water?
Oh, my tent's on fire!
Which is these little tiny doses of water. It's hilarious. Yeah. The things that are funny are, I think, super funny. And the things that are kind of rote and you're expecting it to be like that, it's like, eh. Okay, fine.
Yeah. Other thing that I thought was really funny, when they finally get around to getting Stanley to draw the map, and he turns out, and he just draws a map of how he gets to the department store.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, no, you're supposed to draw the map that was in the book. That is the map. That's where I kept it, in the book.
Yeah.
I wondered why they were wanted to pay so much to for a map for how I get to the department store.
So I think the funny parts were the dialogue. There are other funny parts in it, but all of the physical comedy you see coming way out ahead of time. There's a point where he's trapped in with a lion and he disappears, right? And and I looked at my husband and I said, is he under the box? And he hadn't even seen he was under the box yet. And he goes, yeah, probably. And then, of course, he's under the box. And so, but I almost said there's a little more emotional maturity in this. I think that's what I'm looking for is emotional maturity. So, like you said, there's not, even though at one point they talk about how cruel Abbott is to Costello, or to, I forget what he's called, but Livington is what Costello's called in the movie. But, you know, they're like, oh, he was so cruel. He's so mean. Oh, yeah, you know, knocks him around all the time. But you don't actually really see that in here. There's more kind of the permeating kind of idea that Abbott is a lot more intelligent than Costello. But there's a real, you guys are going to love this equation. There's a real kind of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead aspect to this, because you've got this idea the whole time that there's this one guy that he knows he's the smart one and the other guy's the dumb guy. But then when you stop and you look at it and you go, but Gary Oldman is asking all these really intelligent questions that Tim Roth isn't thinking of. And it's kind of the same with this. It's like, yeah, Abbott is nominally the intelligent guy, but then all of the things that Costello kind of stops and looks at you and goes like, wait a minute though, wait, like, you know, which, you know, but if you were dead and in a box, would you know you were in a box? Like, you're dead. You don't know you're in there. So does it really matter? It's that same kind of feeling, I think. So it is, I think Costello's a lot of fun to see. And I mean, you know, you've got that classic funny guy, straight guy dynamic going on. I can't think of anything that Abbott actually does that's actually funny in it. I don't think he does. He's just the straight man.
He is a straight man. And that is what Abbott did in the routine. And he was the straight man. He set things up for Costello.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their shtick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a, oh God, Sorry. You know you've hit rock bottom when you're talking about a couple of comedians from the 1940s and you realize that your Abbott and your husband is Costello. or at least
my wife probably feels the same way as you.
it's possible there's a large portion of us out there that have that kind of relationship. Very, very, yeah, it just struck me, and I thought I'd better explain why I suddenly sounded like I might be dying from something. It is that kind of married couple relationship, though, and it's not anything new. It happened all the time, and there were lots of these kind of acts around, and I think, you know.
Oh, sure, I mean, this goes back to even Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, if you look around long enough, you're going to find this kind of dynamic that you find enjoyable and funny to watch. And it might be Abbott Costello. It might be somebody else.
I do think that even though this is one of what I would consider one of their lesser films, I think it's still entertaining. And there is some really fun and clever bits and sight gags and things. Even the, you know, when they're captured by the cannibals and the pots, they've got the water got going. Of course, they've got one tall, thin pot and one short, fat pot.
You know, I actually didn't even catch that. I just was looking at it going, wow, these people have like really advanced pots for what their huts look like. This is the voice of a history person going, wait, is that period appropriate? Oh my gosh, you're exactly right. There is a tall, thin one and a short. That's funny. That's really funny. It's funnier if you get it, though, isn't it?
Yes, very. There is some nice bits with Abbott, you know, when they find the diamonds and he's collecting the diamonds and he asks, he gives them to Costello to hold so he can pick up a couple more. Then he looks and notices Costello's holding the diamonds. Give me those diamonds back.
Yeah,
trying to take my diamonds.
Yeah. Or when he gives him the map and he's like, this map is worth $1 million. Wait. And Costello says, aren't you going to give me anything for it? He goes, yeah, here's a nickel. And he's like, hey, a nickel.
Ooh, a nickel. Abbott is holding the lion cub, trying to get, I keep using their names and not their characters' names, but
me too. Johnson and Livingston.
Yes. He's holding the lion cub, trying to get Stanley to go ahead, touch it. And he barely touches it with his finger. And he, you know, did you see? Oh, did you see that? Oh, just like it, trying to describe comedy. You know, we do this every time when we review a comedy.
Comedy and action, they're so hard.
They are very difficult to try to describe. But it's a great little moment, and it's so much fun watching Costello do that kind of stuff. Like I said, every time we do comedy, we have a hard time actually talking about the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because there's nothing, there's never anything to it. It is not, you know, a real intriguing and deep and, you know, involved plot or anything. It's, mm-mm, here's some bad guys. They want diamonds. They drag our characters along. Hilarity ensues, you know.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard just to talk at all.
Yeah.
It is really tough to talk about. I think, you know, we talk, there's not a lot to the script, as you said. We talked a little bit about the production value, which, you know, it's a staged, it's filmed on a stage. It's a closed set. You know, they're not on location anywhere. It looks exactly like you expect something from, you know, 1949. Filmed on a back lot, supposed to be Africa to look like. There's a scene you mentioned with the cannibals where they're, you know, they're stirring the pot and whatever. And I had a flashback to Singing in the Rain when they're walking. I know. I had a flashback to Singing in the Rain. No, where Don Lockwood and he's hilarious. I'm so sorry I can't think of his name right now. You guys are screaming it at me right now. I can't think of his name. He's walking along with his friend, and they're walking across these different sets to go to the soundstage where he's going to be filming. And in the background, they have like almost this exact scene, but they're like dancing around instead. They're like, more smoke, guys, you know. And I love it because it's, of course, on a silent set. It's not a soundstage at that point. It's a silent set. And, you know, the director's there with the whatever you call it, the bullhorn. It's not
the megaphone.
The megaphone, yeah, like just yelling, yeah, more smoke, guys, more smoke, bigger actions. But it's like exactly this. It's just kind of fun to see something like Singing in the Rain where they're showing this, and then you watch another movie and you're like, oh, that looks almost exactly like it. But I did wonder, like, how did they do the river? Because it's not very much water. It's got to be on a just a sound, like on a sound stage somewhere.
Yep.
The little gag with the egg beater made me laugh. If you haven't seen it yet, you'll find out when you see it. But it's, there's not, you know, production value wise, there's not a whole lot that went into it. I feel like the big money went into the big names, like you said.
And the animals on set.
Yes, which is, I think, part of that. But other than that, there's really not, even just the alligator, or the crocodile that's in the water, like, and it just, like, pops up, and then it just, like, pops down, and it's so obviously somebody just holding a fake alligator. It's so obvious.
There's a stick and, just off frame, yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's a little bit funny because it's so obvious, mm-hmm. but it's also just a little bit silly. That I'm not going to say what happens at the end, but I really appreciated the ending. I felt yes. like there's right before they leave the jungle, right after they escape the cannibals, there's a whole thing that happens, and there's a special effect. I don't want to say what it is, because if you haven't watched it, this it's really worth watching for the special effect. I think this is not, this is an era where it's so easy to get things wrong on film. And I think that there's this bit where, you know, the cannibals are chasing him and then they run away for a reason. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they run away, it would have been so easy to get it wrong. And they got it right. And I actually laughed out loud, especially considering there's this theme that's going on through the whole movie where they're looking for something specific. And then, you know, this happens. And I really appreciated that. I think the production value on this is better than I would have expected it to be. And it's also so much worse than it could be in some places. But where it's good, it's really good. And where it's bad, it's kind of funny because it's so bad. Mm-hmm. And you don't know if they're like, I think it's meant to be funny. I think that the bits where you can tell it's a fake alligator or crocodile, it's supposed to be funny.
Right. No, yeah. I don't think those were in any way meant to convince someone that there's a real alligator there with them.
It's not Roger Moore running across the backs of a bunch of them or the stunt guy for him.
No. I think most of the money went into the cast, which is, for the story, it's a large cast.
It is a large cast for the story. I'm just going to repeat everything you say moving forward. But you're right. For this small of a storyline, a shocking few number of women.
Yes. Well, especially when you bring in, for whatever reason, you decide, oh, let's have Frank Buck come in, you know, this other famous hunter.
Yes. Which I would have loved to have seen more of him.
Yeah, doesn't really, you could have cut him out of the film entirely, you know, and saved a few bucks, but must have been someone's friend, you know, yeah. or someone owed a favor.
Yeah, that is, you know, gosh, there's so many things that happen in these movies where it's like, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when that happened, when somebody decided this person was going to be in this, or this scene was going to be shot, or, you know, hey, let's go get another famous person.
Right. We don't need two heavies, but we've got them here.
Yeah. And they're huge.
Yeah, oh, yeah. These are big guys. Well, they're professional huge. Boxers, both mm-hmm. of them.
Yeah.
You've got Joe Besser as, you know, the sort of butler or whatever he is of Diana's who yeah. comes along to Africa. But then you also throw in Champ Howard, who's supposed yeah. to be the follow-up guy. You know, if you miss, he'll shoot and kill the charging animal. And of course, the gag is the guy's blind as a bat.
He's got bottle glasses on. Yeah. And that was such a funny scene too. I think the thing for me was that the funniest stuff to me happened before they ever left for Africa.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just all the little ridiculous gags. It's the over-the-top gags that kind of make you chuckle.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know. What else do we want to say about this?
We have a tendency to want to talk a little bit longer, but this is such a simple story and so much of it is comedy. And there's, you know, we're not going to talk about, oh, the dialogue. Did you catch this? Did you catch that? I mean, I guess we already have kind of talked about that. The end of it is clever. It's funny. I really appreciated it. You know, it's a classic buddy comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, that's exactly what it is. It's a classic buddy guy. But in what else do you say about it? I mean, if you've seen one, I don't want to say if you've seen one, you've seen them all. But if you've seen one, you've seen them all. You know what's going to happen. Probably not. Well, neither of the guys is going to die by definition in a buddy comedy. They can't die. You know, this isn't Beau Geste out here, guys. Like, but yeah, I don't think there really is anything else to say. I want to say, oh, did you see so-and-so's performance or so-and-so was so funny? Or there's no dramatic content at all in the movie. And I'm a little sad, too. Actually, you know what? That is something we can talk about. That there is this kind of great femme fatale kind of nefarious character, this woman in it. And then
sidelined to fit, make room for more Abbott and Costello shenanigans?
Not even that, but what happened to her at the end?
Oh, that's right. You know, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. Oh, right. What happened to the... Oh.
She completely disappears.
Yeah, she just literally, they run out of a hut and that's it. She's just gone. I mean, the same with everybody else. We assume that Clyde Beatty's fine.
Yeah.
You know? We assume that all of the people that make their living, you know, Frank Buck and probably, well, I mean, there's actually a whole lot of stuff that's, I wouldn't say resolved by monkeys, but maybe you can say, I don't even have a good pun. I wish I had a good pun for this, but the monkeys take care of a lot of stuff at the end. And I don't know if you just are meant to assume that they were just eaten by chimpanzees or what? Yeah. I mean, according to Edgar Rice Burroughs, they would be taken and raised by at least one of the chimpanzees. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose if you want it, you could claim that this film is rather dark by the death count, the potential death count.
I mean, I guess you could assume that everybody just was lost to the cannibals unless you actually see them at the end of the movie. But that would literally be everybody but Abbott and Costello. You just don't know what happened to anybody but them.
Right.
But it is an Abbott and Costello comedy. And so I guess you don't expect to find out what happened to anybody else.
Well, to quote Abbott in the a line that he repeats many times in the film, I just can't understand it.
maybe the answer is you're not supposed to.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. Yep.
Do we just want to go ahead and jump to ratings then?
I think that's where we're at. There's not a lot else we can do without giving away the big scoop at the very end. And
right.
I think anybody that's going to watch this, you're going to enjoy it. Honestly, if you haven't watched it and you're listening to this podcast, what are you thinking? Why in the world would you listen to us talk about this for an hour without having seen it? But, do go ahead, go back and watch it. You know, Christopher mentioned that this isn't their biggest film. And so that's an interesting question when we're talking about rating this. This is probably not their best movie. This is the one that's out of copyright.
It's not the one that I would consider their worst either. It's just not their best.
Yeah. And so rating it, well, gosh, are we rating it on a scale of Abbott and Costello? Are we rating it on a scale of the Three Stooges? Because,
How many woos would you give this one?
But if we're rating it compared to Rain, this movie is awful.
Yeah, what other films that took place in the jungle can we rate it against?
Oh, good Lord, yes.
And so we got Rain, Road to Bali.
so many options here. But yeah, if we're talking, I think, just general entertainment value, do we recommend, if you have an hour and 18 minutes to sit down and watch a movie, is this the one you should pick up?
You could absolutely do worse is all I'm saying.
Yeah. This is by far not the worst movie we've watched. It has an ending. Well, yes. I mean, for at least some of the characters, there is an ending. And we've watched movies that literally have no ending. They just stop and you go, wait, what? So there, yeah, there's some lack of closure in some aspects, but there's definitely closure at the end. So yeah, I'm curious to know, Christopher, what you would go with on the Othel score.
If we are just going as just a general, a film and entertainment, and kind of leaving out the trying to rate it on the Abbott and Costello scale of films and everything, I would give it a good, solid 3. Because, yes, it's a fun comedy from the late 40s. It has some really great moments. There are some moments where you're just thinking, okay. But then there's usually something else that comes along after that kind of, picks you back up and takes you along until the next little, and lets you get through maybe the next little dip, in the film. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'd easily give it a 3, and I'd even, push it up to a 3.5.
Okay, fair enough. So it's interesting because I thought I was going to rate this higher. But then as you were talking, I realized, actually, you know what? If I were rating this out of all the films and of all the films and all the cities and all the world, I thought, actually, as plot goes, it's pretty standard. As acting goes, it's pretty basic. As dialogue goes, it's okay. And there are, I think, so many comedies out there that even from around this area, and we've talked about one already multiple times on this episode, that are, I think, funnier and richer. And I'm kind of torn. I want to go between a 3 and a 2. And so I don't think I can go a 2 because it's not bad. It's not like, wow, this is subpar, but I definitely couldn't go over a 3, even though I was kind of thinking at first, there's some merit in this. There is some merit to this movie. And you know what? If you want to watch something funny with your kids, this is probably a solid option.
Very safe film. Very safe bet to watch. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing scary going on. Even though, I mentioned PETA not being happy, there's not any obvious animal cruelty. There's just questionable training tactics.
Yeah, there's a kitten that may or not have gotten its wits scared out of it in the very beginning of the film.
That's true. That is true. I think a 3 for me. I can't go above a 3. But, there's so many caveats to comedy that... Mm-hmm. Then that was unintentional alliteration. But I'd give it 3 Othels. And I think, if I were forced to compare it to some of our five Othel movies, I would have to go down a half an Othel. But in this case, I think I'd be interested to see a little more Abbott and Costello. There are other comedy duos that are out there, or trios even, that we've seen where we've both just gone, not for me. Yeah. In this case, I think they're okay.
Yeah, there. We've seen a few where we're just, why did they put them in a movie? Yeah.
Yes. These guys are probably hilarious on a stage, but not in a movie. These and Abbott and Costello, I think, in a movie are pretty reasonable. There's, I think, maybe for me, gosh, guys, I love romance, and so maybe a little bit of my sadness about this movie is because there's not any kind of romantic intrigue.
Mm-hmm. I honestly think Abbott and Costello are strongest live or in front of a live audience. When you see them do the television shows,
yeah,
I think that is where they're at their strongest, because they do that little, especially Costello, he starts breaking the fourth wall at the audience and whatever. And Abbott is struggling to try to pull the act back.
Yeah. And I can see, that's even funny in this movie where he does that, I think is one of the,
he does it a lot in this movie.
I believe you. Yeah. I'm trying to think, just the one time stands out to me really. But, you mentioned that you have seen a lot of their TV or more of their TV shows and listened to their radio plays. And I think probably though that might be the better option. I would say if you asked me to rate this on the Abbott Costello scale, and then probably if we had to and say, hey, if the best thing they've ever done is a 5 and the worst thing they've ever done is a 1, this is probably lower. This is probably a 2 or mm-hmm. lower than a 2 because there, I think you're right. I think there's other content out there. If what you're saying is right, there's a really good chance that they get a lot of their energy from a live audience.
Yeah, that's very much the case.
Even when he's talking to Clyde Beatty and he's saying, oh yeah, that Clyde Beatty's a faker and this and that, and, you know, and he's going on about it. You can see Clyde Beatty's kind of cracking up. And so mm-hmm. I can see how, you know, the people that are there that are responding to him or to them are showing you how much more fun it would be to see them in person. So yeah, I think, you know, if we're going on the Abbott and Costello scale, meh, 2. But if you're going, hey, you know, wholesome fun movie, watch with the kids, a little bit of fun, some silliness, yes, this is probably a solid 3.
The listeners of this show haven't heard me talk about this thing I go to almost every year called Monster Bash, mm-hmm. which is a celebration of like the classic monsters from the 30s, 40s, 50s, the Dracula, Frankenstein, all that stuff, and just anything in general. Of course, Abbott and Costello, towards the end of their film career, their career was starting to kind of be on the decline, same as the Universal Monsters. You know, so Universal had the idea, let's put the two together. And they came up with Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which is by far one of their best films.
So a 5 on the Abbott Costello scale.
It is a 5, yes. So Monster Bash decided to kind of celebrate that. And they had these Abbott and Costello impersonators appear at Monster Bash. And they came out and did their routine and hung out and spent the entire weekend with everybody.
Fun.
They dressed up and, you know, and acting. It was Joe Ziegler and Bill Riley. And it was so much fun to meet these two because they were so good. And they looked the parts. They were so much fun. And I was able to, you know, get my picture with them and everything. I'm like, this is like as close as I would ever get to like meeting like comedy icons. And then it was very unfortunate that it was just a couple years later that Joe Ziegler passed away. Mm. I believe it was Joe Ziegler passed away unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. And it was just the entire kind of Monster Bash family was just sort of crushed.
Oh, yeah.
But it was such a thrill meeting them, and you know, they were so well versed in Abbott and Costello and their routines mm-hmm. and everything, and then to have the look and be able to sit there and joke with them for just the briefest of moments I was in an Abbott and Costello film.
That's so fun.
it was so cool.
Oh, that sounds really great.
I'll have to try to dig up the photo of me with them and send it to you.
Yeah. Well, and we're in that weird kind of space, right? We get so excited about 6,000 subscribers, you know, in a world where people are like, I've got 2 million subscribers. But, you know, we're also in a space where we can't meet a lot of the people that we're talking about. They just aren't around anymore. And even, you know, the people that love them and portray those characters, you know, they're harder and harder to come by. So, that's really special to get to even meet somebody that loves what we do as much as we love what we do is so much fun.
Yeah. Well, I think that'll probably do it for Africa Screams. Lydia, as always, it's so much fun to talk about this stuff with you. And even when the film is difficult to talk about, I feel like I'm going to have a hard time even pulling clips from this one because so much of it is such a visual.
Yeah, facial expressions and sound effects. Yeah.
Yeah, but I will do my best. Hopefully by the time you hear this, you will have already heard something. But yeah, that will do it. We'll be back in a month for another film, and we look forward to you guys joining us. And of course, if you have any thoughts, drop an email to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com or follow the link in the show notes to the social media sites. Lydia, thanks. I guess I'll talk to you in a month.
Yay. Looking forward to it.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.